From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Philippe Jalli, U.S. chief correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Washington-based CBS radio contributor Michael Williams.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Diplomatic relations between Russia and the U.S. took another downward turn as Russia expelled 60 U.S. diplomats and ordered the closing of a consulate in response to the expulsion of Russian diplomats from the U.S. and other countries. A deal between Russia and Saudi Arabia is being finalized that would give the two countries unprecedented control over world oil prices and signals a new balance of power in Middle East politics. North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un made a surprise visit to Beijing for talks with Chinese leader Xi Jinping, a move that has considerable impact on the North Korean leader's upcoming meetings with U.S. President Donald Trump. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley announced that the United States will limit its monetary contribution to peacekeeping efforts to 25%. And the job of a head of state is never an easy one, but President Trump seems to have more than the usual share of challenges. Our panelists today will help him sort it out. So, gentlemen, we have a lot to cover, so let's get going. Let's start with the Russian diplomats. 29 countries have expelled a total of 150 Russian diplomats, and now the Russians have responded by expelling U.S. diplomats and closing the consulate in St. Petersburg. Let's start with you, Tom, if you would. Please quickly recap the events that led up to this series of expulsions.
Well, obviously, Michael, The use of a military-grade nerve agent against two Russians living in Britain, a former intelligence officer for the Russians and his daughter, was the triggering factor here. They're both in the hospital. The daughter seems to be coming along. Her father is still in critical condition. But apparently, the fact that the Russians have been saying for years, well, we worked on this stuff years ago, but we don't do it anymore, and then they used it. Western intelligence is absolutely certain that the Russians were behind this, and they did it with malice aforethought, and apparently the whole Western political apparatus decided we have to do something, and we have to do it together to back up British Prime Minister Theresa May.
Philippe, do you think that the exchange of diplomats, these sort of dueling expulsions, does that type of action have any effect on the behavior of nations? Is it an effective way to send a message or to even punish a leader for having taken a particular action?
I'm not sure it impedes the functioning of diplomatic exchanges between the countries involved. It sends a strong message, obviously. You have to keep in mind that there has been 14 suspicious deaths in the UK alone in the past 6 years, I think, of people related to the Kremlin. There has been a very suspicious death of Mikhail Lesin here in Washington, D.C. The recent a story in BuzzFeed recently saying that the FBI has four witnesses saying that he was beaten to death. I think there was a story, very interesting story in the Washington Post this Friday about how his advisors sold the move to President Trump, who is very soft in his addressing Vladimir Putin himself, but quite tough in his policies. And apparently they offered him three options, arguing in favor of the middle one, comparing using a boxing metaphor, saying you can punch him solidly in the nose, but still keep some strength for in case of retaliation. They didn't even give him the numbers, the exact numbers, which is amazing because there hasn't been ever such a high number of diplomats expelled. It's more than under Reagan in 86, 60 people there. At the time, it was 55.
Well, Tom, Philippe mentions the relationship between Trump and Vladimir Putin, this personal relationship that Trump has said many times. He's gone on record saying that the reason he tries to cultivate that relationship is to foster a bridge in case we need to resolve problems. And this certainly, I would think, qualify as one of those times where you could call it a problem. Do you think that relationship is, in fact, a bridge that Trump can walk over?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the Russians have just been angry since the Obama administration in its closing months threw out some Russians and closed one of their recreational centers on the Chesapeake Bay. And I think they'll be even angrier about this for something that the U.S. did that has not been given a lot of attention. It's not a coincidence that the Russians have a consulate in Seattle. That seems like a strange place to have a consulate in the Pacific Northwest, except it's very near to one of the Navy's largest submarine nuclear ballistic missile bases in the world. And it's also not a coincidence that many of the Russians at that consulate in San Diego have been identified as Russian intelligence agents, no doubt trying to get information. It's also not a coincidence that one of the largest airplane manufacturer in the world, the Boeing Corporation, is in Seattle as well. So I think that retaliation against the Russians in Seattle is going to sting a lot more than the U.S. losing its consulate in St. Petersburg. And that, I think, is something that Putin will have to pay attention to.
And, Philippe, I'll give it to you for the last word on this one. In this effort to address and confront Vladimir Putin, there seems to be a requirement for some sort of unanimity in approach. Is President Trump in a position to be the leader of this effort, or will it be one of the European leaders that will be more of the driving force in this issue?
Well, I think it's no coincidence that the Russians expelled American diplomats first. They did that on Thursday, and they started retaliating to the Europeans' move on Friday only. So, no, I mean, it's a one-on-one between the U.S. and Russia. The Europeans, I think, can play like a go-between in some occurrences, in some occasions, but there has to be some one-on-one agreement, or just to admit that there is no ground for agreement between the United States and the U.S. president and the Russian president.
So you see it as two separate tracks?
Well, the Europeans are much closer to Russia than the United States, and they would like to have a more appeased relation between the West and the Russian bloc, if you want. But it all depends on the U.S. attitude on this. And when you have to choose your camp, what we see is that Western Europe still sides with the United States.
Okay. Let's move on to the Russia-Saudi oil deal, and we could say proposed oil deal. Russia and Saudi Arabia have agreed in principle to cooperate to control oil prices on the global market over a period of 10 to 20 years. The deal is unprecedented in its scope and in its length. I'll start with you again on this one, Philippe. The obvious objective here is to support oil prices on the global market, which Saudi Arabia, OPEC, and Russia have done for years. Mm-hmm. Why is this deal different?
Well, it's different because, as you mentioned, it's the intention is to strike a deal for the next 10 or 20 years. So far, there had been these sort of agreements starting early 2016 on a yearly basis to stabilize the oil prices, which were at the start around $30 a barrel. And this kind of deal has allowed the prices to go back to around $60 a barrel.
And I think that's so, around 2016, they sort of bottomed out at
right.
$30 a barrel.
And so it makes sense for them. What is interesting is that they want to strike a deal for 20 years. That means basically that Russia, which is not a member of OPEC, would become a de facto member. That's one point. The second one is that you see a pretty good relationship between Saudi Arabia and Russia, which is weird because Russia is very friendly to Iran. They cooperate in Syria. I mean, they have a lot of opposite interests in the region, and Russia is extending its influence in the region. And Saudi Arabia is playing a very friendly game with the United States, with Israel. I mean, it's getting more and more complicating by the day there.
It truly is. And I'm going to turn to you, Tom. My feeling is that this signals a furthering of Russia's wanting to inject itself into Middle East policy. How would you characterize this move in terms of their overall ambitions in the Middle East? And do you think that the U.S. can in any way intercede in this? What are the U.S. interests in this particular thing?
Well, I think the U.S. interest is more making nice with Saudi Arabia than with Moscow here. And I think relations between the new Saudi crown prince and the U.S. Are good. They want to buy more of our weapons, although some in the U.S. government are worried that if we sell them, say, F-35s, which is the new state-of-the-art weapon, someone in Moscow might be offering a lot of money for some details of those weapons. And so this is part of the political and geopolitical component here. They both want to be bigger players in the world than they are at the moment.
So I'll finish with a big question that has a short answer. Does this make the world a safer place or a more dangerous place?
Probably more dangerous.
Okay. On that happy note, we'll take a break and we'll come back with more issues in the news.
This program is coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. A reminder that Issues in the News is available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Philippe Gély, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Michael Williams, Washington-based CBS Radio contributor.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Let's move to China and North Korea. Our Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, dictator, made what is believed to be his first overseas trip, visiting the Chinese Premier Xi Jinping in Beijing for 2 days, with the North Korean dictator getting pieces in place before planned meetings with the leaders of South Korea and the United States. Tom, I'll turn to you. Who initiated this meeting and who set the agenda? What's on the agenda for this?
Well, I think the Chinese have more cards here, so I'm guessing that they probably originated this. But Kim Jong-un was more than willing to do this because he has felt burned by the Chinese in the past in big power situations. And I think President Kim wanted to make sure that he and the Chinese were on the same wavelength. But also the Chinese wanted this meeting to send a message to the United States. And I think it was not another coincidence that China announced this meeting only after Kim had gone back to North Korea. And the U.S. had no inkling this was happening, which I think was another message to the United States, which is we're players here, too. Don't take us for granted.
Philippe, China said that it had briefed the White House, as Tom mentioned, after the meeting. Given the mini trade war that the administration started with China recently and China's interest in expanding its influence across Asia, what assistance do you think the U.S. can truly expect from China in its efforts to denuclearize the peninsula?
It's a complicated question.
That's what we do here.
Yes, I know. I don't think they can assume that they will get cooperation from China on this matter. They will get it to a certain extent. But what happened there, and I think it's, again, a smart move on the part of Kim Jong-un, he managed to secure a summit with the U.S. president, which neither his father or grandfather could get. Now he's going to China to put China back on his square. And the statements that came out of this meeting, there are two crucial points for him. One is that China is opposed to a military solution to this problem. The second one is that China basically aligned with Kim's vision of how it should proceed from now on, which is a slow, synchronous progress toward peace with, reciprocal moves. And what is missing right now is what is the U.S. plan on how to proceed? How do they want to get to the denuclearization? This won't happen in one summit. So we haven't heard any specifics on the part of the American administration about how they want this to proceed. And what do they want to achieve first at the summit and then after that?
And beyond,
exactly. It seems that for President Trump, it was supposed to be some kind of trilateral thing with South Korea, North Korea, and the U.S. Now it's a
series of bilaterals, it seems.
Exactly. Like. You have two camps. Yep. And in what camp, I think you can put Kim and Xi, who, by the way, dislikes very much Kim Jong-un. But still, he rolled the red carpet for him.
Right.
And on the other side, you have South Korea and the U.S., and they don't have a strategy.
And I'll just say that Mr. Trump, President Trump, expressed optimism on Twitter about the potential for diplomatic success in the upcoming meeting, saying there was a good chance that Mr. Kim would do what is right for his people and for humanity. At her daily briefing, the White House press secretary, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, offered no concerns about Mr. Kim's visit. Her quote, again, is that we feel like we've made significant progress, we being the administration, the U.S. administration, and we're going to continue to move forward in this process. There seems to be some optimism on the part of the U.S. Administration about this denuclearization, as Philip points out, is very complicated. Tom, do you think that this optimism is justified?
It remains to be seen, but there's no real evidence that it's warranted at the moment. Let's not forget that the new White House National Security Advisor, John Bolton, is widely known as a controversial, provocative, anti-North Korean, anti-Iranian, anti-Chinese agent provocateur. The other issue, setting aside his cowboy personality, Mr. Bolton, is that it's hard to believe that the North Koreans are going to do the right thing, as President Trump suggested or described it, because I think their nuclear arsenal is what Kim thinks makes them a player.
I agreed, and the team that plans that strategy seems to be quote-unquote ever-changing, and we'll get into that in a minute. First, very quickly, I want to touch on a issue that presented itself this week at the United Nations. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, made a statement saying that the U.S. will no longer pay any more than one quarter of the multi-billion dollar cost of the United Nations peacekeeping operations. Her quote is that peacekeeping is a shared responsibility. All of us have a role to play, and all of us must step up. The U.S. is the biggest contributor to the fund at approximately 28.5% of a $7.3 billion peacekeeping budget. Philippe, who is most affected by this announcement, and do you think it makes the world a more dangerous place when the U.S. declares limits on peacekeeping contributions?
I think it's fair. So far, they were paying 28.5% of an $8 billion budget. The budget has been reduced to $6.8 billion. The tricky part is that it's on behalf of the General Assembly. It's not the Security Council who is establishing this budget. So it's 193 countries, and it's a headache just to establish the budget. And now, okay, the U.S. says we'll cap it at 25%. I'm not shocked that they're asking that. The second contributor is China with a little more than 10%. There is one thing we should keep in mind is that the U.S. is not contributing in troops. Only a few dozen blue helmets are Americans in the world. The most contributing countries are Ethiopia, Bangladesh, and Rwanda, with over 8,000 soldiers each.
That is a fascinating statistic we learn here on this show. Tom, I'll go to you for the last word on this subject. Do you think this is good policy, good politics for the base, or both?
It's probably both for the base, for Trump's base, which he is desperate to hang on to as he heads into a difficult November 2018 midterm election for Republicans running for re-election. It's not surprising. Trump has little use for the United Nations. He campaigned against it. He said it's a vast bureaucracy. There's all sorts of corruption.
I think obsolete was one of the words he used, including NATO. And
so this should not be surprising that he is not a big fan of the UN.
I think I agree with you that it's not really a big surprise. It's kind of an easy thing to take. And also, it is very justifiable, unlike some of the other things that you may point to in terms of the pulling out of these unilateral things. I think there's a fairness to it. And I think Nikki Haley even referred to a legal statute that supports the move. So in terms of controversy or significance, I think this one is pretty far down and the list of things that the Trump administration has done. So speaking of the Trump administration, we had a tough time trying to combine the domestic part of the show this week, and we had so many things, and so I decided to take a little bit different tack and have you guys participate in a little bit of a game, if you will. So we have John Bolton. being named the National Security Advisor. You have North Korea, which we just talked about. You have continued shakeups in the rest of the administration. New veteran administration secretary has just been named, and others are apparently on the hot seat. You have redistricting in Pennsylvania that has led to either the retirement or decisions not to run of a number of Republican candidates, incumbents, which would point to a all-out disaster in the upcoming 2018 midterm elections for the Republican Party, of which the president is the de facto head. You have, of course, the Mueller investigation and the difficulty in finding staff to fight that battle on that front for the president. And last but not least, you have the specter of a legal battle with a former adult film star who is refusing to honor an agreement not to speak about an alleged affair with the president in 2012. And hints that other such litigants may be waiting for their turn on stage. So, as we said, the president has never been an easy job, but it's going to get easier because each one of you has been named chief of staff. And for Philippe, it's the first French chief of staff in U.S. history.
Definitely.
So congratulations for making history. You know that the president doesn't like to have long and complicated briefings. He's going to give each of you a minute and a half to set priorities for the next 90 days for the good of the administration. So I'm going to let you go first, Philippe. You're the new chief of staff. You have a minute to a minute and a half to set priorities for the president for the good of the administration.
Well, the tricky part in your game is that on your list, there are things that are, which stakes are very high for the country, even for the world, in the case of North Korea, and some others, the stakes are high for the president himself, right? So since I keep in mind that I'm from France, even though I've been just appointed...
He knew that when he appointed you.
A National Security Advisor, which I'm very proud of. I would put the world, the international issues on the top of the list. Not only North Korea, but also Iran. We haven't mentioned Iran, but I mean, a deadline is coming very soon on May 12th. And my advice as an advisor would be not to destroy an agreement, whatever its positive side or negative side, if you don't have anything to replace it. That's the case with Iran. You can destroy the nuclear deal that was struck in 2015, but what you will have is a second North Korea issue problem, okay. The same kind of issue.
Okay.
So I would advise the president against that. And I also would advise the president trying to set up a strategy, not be caught playing chess with someone who is playing another game, you know?
Okay.
What I mean?
In terms of
the Mueller investigation is definitely a very high stake, I think, for the president. The midterms relates to a global issue on his behavior. I would advise to behave as a president if you want to be reelected and if you want to win elections. Behave as the president of all Americans, not only your base.
Okay, and I'm going to cut you off there because remember, you had a minute and a half. You know, this president has
just one word on Stormy Daniel. I have no idea how serious it is. The only hint is that he's not tweeting about it. So I guess it must be very serious.
Very good. I like it. So, Tom, and by the way, Tom, you're probably closer to the top of that list than you think. The turnover rate is going on. Chief of Staff.
Well, I would say, Mr. President, first of all, you've got to do something about the chaos surrounding you. I know you've said many times, I thrive on chaos. I love being, in effect, the middle of a three-ring circus. But you've got to do something about the lack of stability and the chaos and the turmoil. Even your base is going to wonder whether you know what you're doing. If you lose even 5% of your base, the Democrats will take over the House of Representatives. And why is that important, Mr. President? Because if the Democrats take the House, that means every committee chairman and every subcommittee chairman will be a Democrat with the power of subpoena. And you will be investigated into oblivion. And all of this, you will be powerless to stop.
What do you advise them to do about Bob Mueller?
I think he's already decided he wants to talk with
Keep
Mueller,
him or fire him.
And I think I would advise him, don't do that, listen to your lawyers, but he has a habit of not listening to his lawyers or much of anybody else.
He is, in fact, his own man. We can say that about our president. That's all the time we have for this week, though. I want to thank Philippe Gilly, U.S. Chief Correspondent for Le Figaro, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. This program is produced by VOA's Current Affairs. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites, and I'm Michael Williams, CBS Radio contributor in Washington, D.C. Thanks for listening.